You're about to listen to Andy Seeley from U.S. CENTCOM, and he'll tell you all about system administration at CENTCOM. Andy?
Hi, I'm Andy. And can you hear me okay? All right, because I'm going to apologize up front. My throat sounds like I'm smoking a couple cartons a day. Usually my voice is quite angelic, and you would say, what a sweet-sounding guy. It ain't going to happen today, so I apologize for that. And also, I like to be a little more interactive and walk over here and point at the screen and walk back over here and talk to you. So, sorry about that. Deal with it. This is my first presentation at LISA, my first presentation at USENIX. This is my first presentation where the crowd is not a bunch of uniforms. So this is new to me. This is very different. It's a little bit of a challenge. I've made a real effort to make really good friends in the last 48 hours, so that way I've got some friendly faces in the crowd. So if you're a friendly face, thank you for being here. And if you're not a friendly face, hopefully you will be by the end of the day. Excuse me. So, purpose of the presentation this morning, Dan Klein's talk, he said every presentation is supposed to have a meaning, right? The meaning of this presentation, because of the types of systems we're talking about, because of where they are, because of what they do, what can you take away from it? If you don't have a security clearance, I can't hire you, so I'm not really recruiting. You can't go down to Best Buy and buy a shrink wrap box of command and control, so what are you going to do with it? My hope with this is to educate you a little bit about a niche. What we do in command and control system support is the same thing that you do wherever it is that you work. But what we do is we do it in a hole inside of a hole. We're all the Morlocks, right? We're all the people that work underground, keeping things running. Now imagine there's an underground to the underground. That's what the command and control system support in the classified environment is all about. So because we're constrained, because we have some limitations, we have some special challenges. We have some unique things that we have to work around to make things happen. That's the nugget that I'm hoping that you'll enjoy, that you'll take away from this. You'll say, at the end of this, I listened to some scratchy guy that could barely talk, and I learned about some new computer systems, some new information processing systems I wasn't really aware of. I learned about mission orientation when it comes to command and control. And I, okay, so I saw some creative little technical tricks. You're going to look at my technical tricks and say, you wrote that code, Andy? Go back to school. Fair enough. But hopefully you'll enjoy it. So that's what we're going to talk about here today. So what is command and control? Say you want to go to war. Pick a country to invade. There's not many left. I know. Let's invade the United States of America, right? Because, hey, no one's invaded them for a while. And that's a good reverse segue, right? Because we just listened, if you were in here half an hour ago, to Kat talking about the Identity 2.0, right? And she was talking about things like need to know and watch out for the government because we're all out to get you. And, you know, so we're all like, oh, yeah, the government, those, ooh, I'm the government. And Mario was just saying, or what was it? Bill was saying, you know, you don't look like you're supposed to look coming from a organization that's the government, you know. And I say, well, they hired me over the telephone, and it's actually true. They hired me. I was working in Germany at the headquarters of the United States European Command. I'm a contractor working for the government, so my feet are on different sides, right? But it was funny that they hired me over the telephone, so I show up with earrings, long hair, tattoos all the way up the arms, and there's two jokes at United States Central Command. One is that they hired me, and two is that I'm still there. So we want to go fight somebody. We want to go have a war. What do you need to do to have a war? What's the first thing you need? You need some guns. You need some information. Information's too good of an answer. Let's dumb it down some. We need somebody to fight. Okay, and that's not been a real problem lately, right? So we find somebody to fight. We need some guns. We need fingers on the triggers of those guns, right? We need to feed the guys, or gals in this case, you know, in the modern army, that are pulling the triggers. We need to know where to send them, how to get them there, the scheduling of it. We need to know who we're shooting at. Are we shooting at the people working in the baby milk factory? Did you all ever see the picture of that the Iraqis published where we bombed the baby milk factory and everybody's uniform said baby milk on the back of it? And it was a preposterous propaganda, but it's a real problem. How do we select a target? How do we know who the bad guys are, who the good guys are? How do we know when to shoot, where to shoot, why to shoot? How do we feed the guy pulling the trigger, and how do we get them all back? That is command and control. To be able to schedule, to plan, to move, to issue commands, to know that the commands came back, kind of sounds like planning kernel scheduling algorithms, doesn't it? To say that I issued the command came back, to have situational awareness, to know where the good guys are, where the bad guys are, and what to do with it. So that's command and control. Force projection. I'm going to get all the guys over there, all the guns over there, all the tanks over there, all the beans, bombs, and bullets. Force sustainment. I'm going to keep sending more beans, bombs, and bullets because when my guys run out, they're going to get shot back, right? And force protection. Once they're there, we need to protect them. What happened was the USS Cole, right, when it was rammed by a little speedboat? Bad force protection. The Cole's a big ship. It can protect itself against big targets, can't protect itself against little targets. So force protection is protecting the force once it's over there. We do mission planning for current and potential requirements. Are we at war with China? No. Is there a plan to go to war with China? Probably. Is there a plan to go to war with everybody? Probably, because we think ahead. We're thinking ahead. Logistics, getting them there and back, intelligence, who's the bad guy? Are we ready to fight? And once we're fighting, where are we is the situational awareness part. So that is command and control from a mission perspective. We're going to go fight the war. And here's a quick look at situational awareness. Now, this is a map of people dying. When you put it in terms like that, you say, oh, this isn't so much fun anymore. I had a conversation over the table with some friends in university that I go to. And the woman was saying, oh, the war in Iraq is such a national imperative. And I said, I'm sorry, but it's not a national imperative. Your son, and I point to a teenager, is not dead. So, sometimes it takes the wind out of our sails to think about what this means, life and death. Now, the joke is, these are some pastel colors. They're very happy colors. There's like sunshine and daisy colors, and I complain about this every time I see the map, and I wanted to complain to you as well. It's a happy map with a sad background. And it's also clearly marked unclassified for the spooks that are listening. So we're talking about the global command and control system. This is a set of a family of systems that implements the command and control function in a computing environment. GCCS is what we call it. Some folks call it geeks. Has anybody ever heard of this? I got five hands, and one of them I talked to just the other day, six hands. So a couple of y'all may have heard of it yesterday. Some of you have heard of it before. The GCCS is a family of systems, and it's incredibly complicated, and it does a pretty good job in spite of or maybe because of that complication. It's made up of a family of subsystems. We have the Joint Operation Planning and Execution System. JOPES is how I decide those guys that are going to ride that Jeep, how do I get them from Fort Drum all the way over to Baghdad? That's the planning and movement system like that. Integrated imagery and intelligence. What am I going to shoot at? Who am I going to shoot at? What do they look like? There are databases where you can search on everybody named Mohammed in Afghanistan. It's an entertaining database optimization problem. Common operational picture is the previous slide I just showed you, showing where all the assets are. Integrated C4I Systems Framework, or ICSIF, is actually the software that runs that. Global status of readiness and training. I have a unit of guys that are carrying guns. Do they all have guns? Do they all have ammunition? Have they all been trained on how not to shoot each other and only to shoot the bad guy? So I'm able to look these things up in a database. Theater ballistic missile warning and display. When somebody lobs a scud at us, can we see it? You've all heard of Patriot. So this is the Patriot missile batteries is related to this. All of these types of information flow through the global command and control system. The challenge is every one of these points is managed by a different program, is funded by a different program, and is put together as a hodgepodge all at once, and then they give it to us down at headquarters, U.S. Central Command. They give it to us wherever we happen to be running the GCCS. So who's using it? We've got the GCCSJ is the Joint Military Community, Joint Chiefs of Staff in the United States, right? You have the chairman and then the Air Force guy and the Army guy and the Navy guy and Marine Corps guy. They have organizations like the Headquarters United States Central Command where I work. This is a U.S. Joint Service Command where we have all the different services together. And so we, very high level, very top level stuff. We're not interested in Sergeant Smith, who's got his finger on the trigger in Foxhole XYZ, we're interested in bigger picture operations. Foreign nations and coalition partners. So we're fighting a global war on terror, and we have coalition partners. And the best ones are the countries that have one guy. You know, you see that in the news sometimes where the island of Tuvalu is part of the coalition of war on terror. Well, they have one guy that happened to be in Washington that day, so he got on the list. So we have foreign nationals, coalition partners, and then each service has a service-specific flavor of this system. So if you're a GCCSJ guy, like I am, and then you go over to the Air Force, well, they have a GCCSAF flavor. Should be the same thing, same kind of problem, right? We're talking about a similar issue. Get the guys over there with the guns and the bullets and let them shoot, except that it's funded out of different programs. It's run by different people, and it has different flavors of everything. Imagine if everything you ever did was Red Hat Linux, and all of a sudden you went over here to Debian Linux. Similar stuff, but every time you turn around, something's a little bit different, a little bit different. It adds an increase of complexity to our job to support these things. So we have the Air Force, we have the Army, the Navy, and the Marine Corps each have their own stovepiped way of looking at command and control as an overall computational system. And in the GCCSA, you've got the FBCB2, Force 21 Battle Command Brigade and below. That actually gets some mentions from time to time on IEEE spectrum, so you may have come across some of these terms along the way. The core strength, they say, is the interoperability. We're taking data feeds from a variety of sources. If you hear about on the news, the Predator. You've got the Predator flying around unmanned aerial surveillance. The Predator data comes into GCCS. Combine that with something like you've got a spy who saw a guy named Muhammad and he writes out a report. That comes into the GCCS. Combine that with a transponder like you've got your transponders that let you go through the toll booths automatically. We have transponders like that that report position and trajectory and things like that. Put that into the mix as well. Readiness reports, scheduling and movement reports, all this have to come together and be processed by the same system from the different services, from the different coalition partners, from the different foreign national people that we work with, from the national assets that come together. So it gets to be a lot of data that's different, and it all has to come together to coalesce to be one picture that a decision maker in the military can say, yes, let's go pull our triggers there, we need to pull back here, or whatever. So these are some of the kinds of challenges that we have and some of the kinds of systems that have to come together. And this is a blatant plagiarism. In fact, anything that's graphics on this is blatantly plagiarized. These represent a variety of systems that feed data into the global command and control system. And I've been doing this job for well over a decade, and I'm going to tell you that I don't know what half of these are, because we don't experience them directly. All we get is, it's like the firemen come up with a pipe screwed into the side of the building, and bang, here we've got some data. Well, where does it come from? You know, what's its pedigree? Can we trust it? Can we not trust it? We don't even have time to trust it. We just take it, and we manage it, and then when the data stops flowing, we make a phone call. So we've got just a variety of data, and it all comes together. The systems themselves. See, aren't you glad we're talking about systems now, right? Because y'all are feeling like you're in some sort of chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff congressional inquiry or something. Back in 96, whenever I started in this, we had the WMICS, we called it, the Worldwide Military Command and Control System. If I was one of those evil guys presenting, I would ask you all to repeat after me several times, Worldwide Military Command and Control System. But as it is, I like you all very much, so I'm not going to do that. If you'd like to do it as an exercise later, though, we can try. We had the mainframes, right? So we had a room this size. Y'all wearing the curmudgeonly little badges there. Remember those. We had the washing machines. You know, look like a washing machine with the disc platters. So we've got disc platters that are like this, disc packs, and they're all top secret, and you can't destroy them, so you got to keep them forever. And there are still warehouses where they're keeping them, I'm sure. And they got rid of that, and they went to a client-server model using Suns. So what do we use? The Sparks 1, 5, 20? If you had a Spark 20, you were really cooking. We had the Solaris 2.3, and we called it GCCS. It came out as GCCS version 2. Version 1, we never actually saw the light of day. Client-server model, right? We had Oracle as a database, and we had Sybase as a database, and we had MiniSQL as a database, all on the same system for some reason. We had Unix workstations on the desktop, which those of us doing the sysadmin piece really liked, because then we could do magic to people. You know, pop up windows, and the user would be like, wow, a window just popped up, okay. And I still get excited about that, in fact. So we went from those, and we had an Enterprise 1000, which is a pretty like a foundation of a building. So and worked about as fast as well. Then we moved forward. We had the Sun Ultras, and those are still in service in a lot of locations. The Ultra 2, the Ultra 5, a lot of people had the 10s sitting on their desk. Anybody using that kind of thing now? They're not bad systems, right? But who's still using the Spark 20? All right, anybody still using a Spark 5? If you're still using Sun's proprietary optical mouse with a metal mouse pad, I'm buying you beer at Lopsa's thing tonight. So then we moved to the Enterprise 6500. Now, it sounds like this is a big deal, right? And it is a big deal in terms of impact, in terms of mission, in terms of lives, in terms of whether or not you agree with the United States foreign policy. We're not about policy here. All we're about is supporting systems. But that policy is in motion, and it is being enacted through these systems. So as a system administrator, the politics, none of my business. Maintaining the systems are. So when you think about that, you'd think this has got to be a data center that is just the size of this, you know, this whole building, this whole hotel, and it's not. We've got a few racks here, a few racks there. So when we got the Enterprise 6500, we were all right. This is some serious business. And it's the size of a refrigerator. When we decommissioned it, I tried to keep it. I wanted to put a refrigerator in it and put it in the house. That would impress my friends, right? So we've gone from there. We had the Windows NT 4.0. Is anybody still running that in their enterprise? We got a couple, right? We're still running it in our enterprise. And it's kind of sad when you think that we're fighting wars this way, but we'll get to why. Solaris 2.5.1. Now, that's a bulletproof operating system. It's my favorite operating system because I think Peter Galvin said the other day, your favorite operating system's always your first, right? Well, that was the one that I really got intimate with. You know the folks that have probably been talking to me for a bit because they're picturing me like, oh, Solaris 251, oh, baby. And it's true. Are we still running Solaris 251? Who of you are? We got a couple of hands. We are still fighting the global war on terror with Solaris 251 and some other stuff, which we'll get to. Why are we still using these legacy operating systems? Why are you using a legacy operating system? It's stable. You have an investment in it, and it's an investment in knowledge. When we moved, and it's a long move because we're still doing it, from Solaris 251 to Solaris 8, we lost something, or we're still losing it because it's a very slow, it's like falling over the event horizon move. But we're losing intimate knowledge of an operating system. When my system does something funny, I know it because I'm intimate with it, as we've already established. When it coughs, I know why it's coughing. Solaris 8, not so much so. So we're losing something. That's part of the reason why we don't move so fast. Next question. How would we install the Solaris 251? We are married to some legacy hardware. If I'm going to run the Sunfire 240 say? Well, I can't run Solaris 251 on this because it doesn't support the processors faster than 400 megahertz. So we keep back with the 420s, the 280s, and we've had problems where we buy a 450 with 450 megahertz processors. You have to go back to Sun and say, Mother, may I, could you please downgrade me so I can run my command and control operating system? And it's just the nature of doing business for us. So now you can see the progression. I don't need to read it out to you. We come up to 2006, which I left off, because we don't know where we are today. We're half and half. Our feet are in two different worlds. We've got the Solaris 251, Windows NT 4.0. We've got Windows 2000, maybe XP tomorrow, maybe next month, and then we've got the Solaris 8. So we're running all of these systems, these operating systems, concurrently, because some of the command and control applications that we run, they require these older operating systems. And it's my favorite little programming thing that the government does, where they'll have a line of code that says, if OS not equal some string, then die. The code doesn't need it. It's just that they try to constrain what can run and what cannot run. So today, we've got the Solaris 8, but also Solaris 251. Tomorrow, we're looking at Solaris 10. Tomorrow, logical tomorrow, not physical tomorrow. And Windows XP. 2010, which is the more you work with government, the more you find dates to be, you know, filled with humor. Net-enabled command and control, net-enabled command capability, formerly was called JC2, the Joint Command and Control System. Well, what they did was they ran out of funding. They never brought it to term, so they changed the name and got a whole new batch of funding. So this happens a lot for us. So our systems move at a glacial rate. In order to stay current, in order for me as a system administrator, professional system administrator with 10 years of experience, how am I relevant to you? By coming here to this, in all honesty, and that is why I'm here. That's why I come to LISA, is so that I can continue to be a professional in the industry. So where do we do business? GCCS is global. That's what the G is for, right? So we as the U.S. military have interests all over the world. Nothing new there. What country haven't we invaded today? But we've been looking at them. They've got great hockey and great beer, but I tell you what, they're easy target, you know, because they're just right there. We're really looking at Venezuela or something. I don't know. Somebody that'll fight back, I guess. That did not come out right. I apologize to all my Canadian friends. I didn't come out right, but it was very funny. As an American who lived overseas for many years, in all honesty, it was just last month I was in Paris and I was lost going through Charles de Gaulle Airport and I saw a guy with a Canadian passport and a kid was lost behind me. I said, "Follow the Canadian; they know where they're going." And I'm rushing way ahead here. So, okay, now you've seen the whole thing. Any questions? Did you all see my VRML thing? Isn't that cool? Help, help! Okay. Yeah, that's... So that's what I get for for poking fun at Canada. And I have learned my lesson. So where do we do business from the United States Central Command, where our responsibility is in not central like central to the United States, but central in terms of the Middle East? The term Central Command sounds a lot more FBI spook-like than it really is. So we have our headquarters in Tampa, Florida, and that's where I live, and I'm a native Floridian, so this is coming home to me. I've worked there for about 2 years now. We have a deployed headquarters in Doha, Qatar, which is one of those little thumb-shaped things on the side of Saudi Arabia. And we have CIFSOC. So here's where it gets challenging for me as a government guy to talk to a non-government folks, because then I have to tell you that means Coalition Forces Special Operations Combatant Command. So you say, okay, that's nice. We have CENTAF in South Carolina. That's the Central Command's Air Force component. CFAC is the Coalition Forces Air Component Command, And that's also in Qatar. ARCENT is the Army component of the Central Command in Georgia. CFLC is the Coalition Forces. It's spelled wrong, not that you would know. Coalition Forces Land Component Command. We have the CSNAC, the CIFMIC here, the Coalition Forces Maritime Component Command. MNCI in Baghdad. Now we're getting to Fox News, right? MNCI, Multinational Coalition Forces in Iraq. We have a coalition joint task force in Afghanistan, and we also have one in Djibouti. In fact, I just came back from Djibouti about a month and a half ago. Has anybody been to Djibouti? Exactly the problem. The question is, where the heck is Djibouti? Djibouti is nestled away lightly between Ethiopia, Eritrea, and Somalia. And if you haven't been there, I'm going to give you a hint. Don't. Sorry about the Canadians, but I'm going to dig on the Djiboutians. So here's a look. And here's Djibouti. It rhymes with certain things, like your booty. So just to give you an idea of the geographical distribution and talking about supporting systems, do we have people at these sites? We do. But what we do is we have, what's the quality of the guy? And they're good quality folks, but you think about who's going to be willing to, you know, sniff camels for a year, 2 years at a time, going to live out of a tin can, going to eat army food 3 times a day for 365 days. And you start to think about staffing challenges. And you start to think about how are these people going to do their jobs when they run into a problem they've never seen before, when they run into a problem that they don't know how to approach. So us back in Tampa, we do a lot of remote support. We do the pick up the phone, you know, they pick up the phone, they call us kind of thing. So Djibouti, we have a task force. Afghanistan, a task force. Nothing in Iran or Pakistan. Iraq, we have a task force. And you can see Bahrain and Qatar and Kuwait are where we have things out there. So the task of system administration. And is this the least bit interesting? Lie to me, please. Because, you know, an ego is a terrible thing to crush. The task of a C2 system administration, command and control system administration, is it different from the system administration that you do? It's the same thing, but it has a different flavor to it. We're both eating the same piece of cake. It's got a different kind of frosting on it. We have mission orientation, where we have the idea that if the server crashes, a guy's going to die. Now, is there a one-for-one? You know, I put my finger on the button or pull the power cord just to teach a guy a lesson? No, of course not. What happens is the situational awareness, the picture that we saw where you can see where things are on the map, that's used by commanders in the field for things like, hey, we have to go rescue a guy because his Humvee got a flat tire, something like that. So this kind of information is important because it's a bad place where we've got our people. So we have to keep mission orientation in mind at all times. Don't take the server down without scheduling an outage and shifting your data feeds to an alternate server, things like that. Reliability and redundancy. It sure would be nice if I had the ability to really savor a problem. I have a server that's running sluggishly or poorly or whatever. I'd like to spend a week or a month really exploring it, but what I do is I go pull another one off the shelf and slap it in the rack and hope it works, because we need to move faster to keep things going. If you're going to fight a war, you want to keep things simple. You don't want complicated gadgetry. You want something that's going to work when you pull the trigger, and by the way, you only want one trigger. Did y'all, if you're a Simpsons fan, do you remember when Sideshow Bob gets in the fighter jet and it has a fly stop button on there, and he says, God bless the United States Air Force? It's that kind of thing. We have to keep it simple rather than complex. And this is a byproduct of that. We keep operating systems around well past their expiration dates, and we keep hardware around that, you know, should be thrown in the dumpster, and we keep plenty of it there so when it fails, we slap another one in. We have to maintain focus and professionalism in a constantly changing environment. Is that unique to us? Heck no. That's unique to everybody in this room, yeah? Because we have to maintain where we are when the ground is constantly shifting under us. To be a system administrator, to keep up with everything, is a real challenge all by itself. I don't know, I haven't talked to everybody here, but I know that in my place of work, I feel pretty smart. I've been doing this a long time, longer than anybody else that works with me. I'm the site's expert on this. I love coming to Lisa because I feel stupid here. And as that happen, if that happens to you, then good on you. It's a good feeling. It's a good feeling to know that you're keeping up, but you're not, you know, that but you know that there's something that has to be kept up with. So flexibility is an additional challenge to us because we don't come to Lisa. We don't go to Usenix conferences. We stay in our little bubbles. Some of our challenges include field conditions. Now, ordinarily, my job is in Garrison. It means I live at home, and I drive to work, and I sit at my desk, and I go back home. But we have some other problems. When you're downrange, when you're forward, when you're in a desert location, your power comes and goes. You've got unreliable communication. Sometimes the network's up, sometimes the network's down. Because we have classified networks, sometimes the crypto gear from one end to the other doesn't work. We forgot to change the crypto key this week, something like that. We have old equipment and no spares. I was in Djibouti, as I was saying, and they were running some significant command and control systems on Tadpole laptops. Where's your spares? We didn't have any. So these are some of the problems that we have. In the environment, you've got dirt and dust, moisture, you've got condensation, scorpions and mortars, I'm not kidding. When you've got this kind of environment where we've got the spiders and the scorpions and the bad things, and the guys in Iraq get shelled. TCN staff, third country national staff, is the different countries in the Middle East tend to hire out of other countries for services. So you've got nothing. You've got people from Philippines, from Bangladesh, from countries like Sri Lanka, countries like this, where you've got people that are doing the housekeeping, people that are cleaning up, people that are doing the grounds maintenance. And you can't. And how can you trust them? Of course you can't. You can't trust anybody to be around your systems. So it's an additional challenge. And people are always moving. People, the military who own the systems, whose missions it is, they are always coming and going. And every time you have a new commander, he has to make his mark. He has to change something so that he can look back as he's leaving and say, that's what I did. Is this like university? I'm so happy you say so, because I've been feeling so alone with this. Because we get a new guy comes in, and he's boss of everything, and he has to change it. Or he's going out, and he has to change it. Isn't? I'm not alone. And we have a lack of resources. We don't have books. We don't have. We might have internet. We might not. We don't have time zones to share. So if the guy out in Kuwait's going to make a phone call to a guy in California, he's got about an hour window before everybody goes to bed. So there's a lot of challenges that we have that are not purely unique to command and control system support, but they are our challenges. So we have the glacial rate of change. We have the tight centralized configuration management. Our systems are delivered to us by the Defense Information Systems Agency, we call DISA, who's our headquarters not too far from here. They hand us a system, and they say it must be this way. It's what they call a type-accredited system. These are the pieces of software that are loaded in this order on this kind of hardware, and you shall not change it. If you change it, it's no longer allowed to be on the network. So we have to answer for our configuration management to very high levels, so we can't change anything. We can't have a compiler, for instance. We can't go get a network monitoring tool. We can't go get all the great gadgets that I hear about when I come here. I can't have any of them. So we have the government off the shelf, the GOTS applications. The government hires folks like, say, Northrop Grumman, like my company, and says, here's the specifications for a product, go write it. And usually the specifications don't include and deliver documentation. So we get these pieces of software, these applications that are written in some, you know, and who knows what languages. There's no source code available. There's no documentation available because the government didn't pay for it. And that's what... So that's what we get delivered to us as part of that tight configuration management. And since the government didn't pay for different companies to talk to each other, Northrop Grumman, we've got Raytheon, say, if we're both working on similar applications, There's no requirement for us to talk to each other, and you end up with people working side by side that don't talk about things like, say, the format of data exchange. You end up with what we call stovepipe systems that don't collaborate well together. And we need the same wide range of expertise that any system administrator needs. At any given day, tune your operating system, fix the sendmail configuration file, grab that GOTS application that's not working and figure out why it's not working. Hey, your cache hit ratio on Oracle is too high. Any of those kinds of things that system administrators run into, we have to keep current. So I picked out a couple of examples of some problems that we've had that we had to monkey around with and find some solutions to. Now, these are not going to be super cutting edge because, well, our systems are not super cutting edge. And also, I apologize, I don't have much in the way of screenshots or code examples because the systems are classified. So I tried to bring out some little nuggets just to entertain, and hopefully that will be interesting. So we've got the Joint Range Extension. Joint Range Extension is a specialized system that just showed up to us one day. Bang, it's in the rack, and it's literally a black box screwed into the rack about 4U high. No documentation, no experience, no knowledge, and big fat serial cables coming out the back that are supposed to plug back into the serial ports of our Sun equipment. We don't know anything about it, but we're tasked with supporting it. And it stops working. So this happens, right? The people who bought it, who did not coordinate with the shop that's supposed to support it, people that bought it were looking for the pallet. Because, you know, they clicked the icon, it wouldn't run, so they were going to send it back. Sounds like my mom, right? So not that my mom has a JRE, but she would say, it does, you know, click it and it doesn't work, send it back. So what do? We can look at the application, we can see the buttons and say, okay, it looks like it was coded in Java. That doesn't really help us any. The only people we know who know anything about it are over in the desert. And it turns out they don't know anything about it. And this is what the JRE does. This is similar to the picture you saw before. There's a lot of different visualization tools, but it shows anything flying. So if you're doing situational awareness work, you got things on the ground, things on the water, things in the water, things in the air. And this is just about things in the air. So what we did was we used truss to trust the application to see where it was going wrong. First thing we did, we found the executable behind the icon, which takes some work sometimes because this shell script runs this shell script, which runs this shell script. And we run it from the command line hoping to tease out some errors. We don't get anything more, except that there's a log file being created. Look at the log file, and we found along the way that it has a lot of log files. It's very verbose, and it's completely worthless. We look at the file system, and we find, you know, because now we found where it was installed. Remember, this came to us as a system, almost like it was shrink-wrapped, pre-installed, pre-everything. So we didn't know. We find the file system where the logs were. We go up one and say, aha, here's a bin directory. Here's a conf directory. Here's all the things you would expect. Bunch of jar files. We find these configuration files, and what do you do when it doesn't work and you've got configuration files? You start monkeying with them. So we make some backups of the configuration files, and let's change this, what happens? Let's change that, what happens? We never fixed it, though we made it a lot worse a lot of times. You know, you can kernel panic one of these pretty easily, it turns out. Turns out there's a help desk for this thing. We call the help desk, and they say, oh, your subscription has expired. I didn't know I had one. So I wait an hour, and I call back. And I say, I've forgotten my account number. Could you please give a brother a hand? And he says, oh, sure. So what's your problem? So I lie to him about my account, but I tell him that here's my problem. And he says, golly, we never heard of that before. Do I have a backup? You know it's good when they're asking you, when the help desk says, do you have a backup? No, I don't have a backup. You gave me this thing. So we finally find in the launch script where it runs the actual applications, and we plug in some truss. If your truss would be like strace in Linux, I'm a Solaris-centric guy, but with some Linux flavor. We're looking at all system calls. We're pulling out expressions. We're following forks, and we're dumping it to an output file. and we run it. Still failed, but now we had system calls that we could tease out. And of course, that gives us 100,000 lines of system calls, which we, you know, grep through and look through. And we end up finding a short read in the bin directory. Now, if you've ever been within 50 miles of a university that once had an instructor who sat in a software engineering class, you would probably not be putting data in your bin directory. It turns out that that's exactly what was happening. The application developer needed to store state for the application, put it in a 6-byte file in the bin directory, and that file got corrupted. So when the application would run, it did a hard read on 6 bytes. It found an end of file marker, crashed right out. We removed the file, it recreated itself, and bang, we're back in business. So this is the kind of problem that we have to solve. Second scenario, the tape gets lost in the mail. Now this is going to be, y'all are going to say, well, hey, what about BitTorrent? Or what, you know, you're going to say, there are so many ways you could have fixed this, Andy. And of course there are, but sometimes a problem sneaks up on you. Sometimes a problem you don't realize is a problem. I've been married to a lovely lady for 11 years and 3 months and 1 week and 6 days and 5 hours. I love this woman greatly, but sometimes I don't realize I'm in a fight until halfway through it, because it sneaks up on you. In the same way, this problem was a sneaky one. I didn't realize we were in catastrophe zone until they're calling the general. And when they call the general, that's like calling the CEO of the company. You know, that's a bad thing. So here's what happens. We've got a trusted Solaris 8 box that's very, very specialized. It's got it does multi-domain security. So we've got 5 or 6 different isolated networks with different classification levels. So it's bad news if data from one goes to the other. And it's so bad news that there's a special team. They work for Lockheed Martin. Do we have any Lockheed Martin guys? Gals? Good. We'll talk bad about them like the Canadians. So we've got the Lockheed Martin team is the only team that can work on this system to make any significant configuration changes. We brought them to Tampa. They set up our configuration. Everything is just fine. We have the same machine over in Camp Asalia in Qatar. It's our backup, our data redundancy. We have to have it the same way. We put them on the plane, and they go over there to the desert. Well, they say, oh, it's going to be so easy. We'll take a level 0 dump of this one. We'll restore it here. We're on site already. We'll make sure that it's good, and then we'll punch out of here and save you $25,000, $30,000 or whatever the cost of their time is. Well, we couldn't hand carry the classified material on the airplane because of restrictions. So they said, we'll just mail it. We got plenty of time. And it never showed up. And it never showed up. This is terrible, isn't it, when somebody gives you a paragraph to read like it's an eye test? So what do we do? What would you do? Well, what you would do would probably be to get a proper FTP client or something like that that would handle lousy comms, and you would just FTP it over. Well, we can't do that because of our configuration management restrictions. So can we mail another tape? The other one took a month to get there, by the way. So no, we're not going to do that again. Can we make a copy of the tape and give it to a guy in uniform with the proper letters and everything that he needs to go through customs and not have them open the package? Turns out that takes 2 or 3 weeks to get all the paperwork done. Can't do that. And it would cost a lot of money for a next day ticket to the Middle East. Can we cancel the mission and reschedule it? Now we're talking about $50,000, $100,000 out of the budget, and then how are we going to send Andy to Lisa? So, you know, we've got to make some trade-offs here, yeah? Can I FTP the tape, the contents of the tape? I've got a level 0 dump of a trusted Solaris 8 box. Can I FTP it? Hey, why not? It's just FTP, right? What? My number 5 there is my reminder to ask you, what would you do? SCP? We have some optimists here. I love it. So first, we need to get the files off the tape. We just DD'd them off. And DD is my test for my junior system administrators. What does it stand for? I got a data dump. Direct to disk. Convert and copy. Copy and convert, right? I think it's copy and convert because when the tool was written, they wanted to name it copy and convert, but there was already a CC for the C compiler. So they just took the next one, DD. At least so I've read on the internet, and you know it's true. So we just do an in file of the tape device and out file to a file, and now we've got a nice big fat level zero dump file. Turns out there's only one partition on that trusted Solaris 8 machine. I didn't design it, so I can't make any excuses. And we go and kick off FTP, and we're all so proud of ourselves, and we go home. And it doesn't work because the comms are so unstable between Tampa and the desert that a file would only go so far, but we wouldn't know because it wouldn't be like FTP would come back and say, hey, knucklehead, you're done. It would just sit there and hang. So the files would never show up, kind of like the tape. So the large files aren't doing any good. I do some tests and say, hey, I can send a smaller file, but I don't have any way to make smaller files out of this big file. So I wrote some code. I'm learning something every day. Ixnay on the itsplay. I was trying to show off my Perl coding, man. Hey, I met Tom Christensen earlier, you know? I'm like, hey, I want Perl. This is split in Perl. And there will be a test afterwards for you. So we wrote some code. We wrote some code to break it apart. And where we can say what size we want. I assume that does everything that split does. So you don't even need to read it. And I wrote something to put it back together. Is there an unsplit? Ah, you guys. I'm a Windows system administrator, by the way. Isn't that good Perl code? I mean, it's really the best you've seen in this room for this presentation, right? So we break it up, we FTP it over, and the idea was I was going to then DD it back onto a tape on the other end. Then we said, hey, why even bother? Let's slap an extra hard drive where we couldn't FTP it to the other trusted Solaris machine because it didn't have an operating system, for goodness sake, right? So we FTP it to another box, extra hard drive, make the same partition, and just UFS restore off the file onto the partition, swap the drives, kablam, we're back in business. We would have been back in business a lot faster had I known about split. So here's another one where the server, we've got a Sunfire 240R, and it's the most important system on the block because it's the system where all the data feeds for situational awareness fuse. So we've got everything that's got wheels coming in here, everything that's got wings coming in here, everything that's going glug glug in the ocean coming in here, and it all comes together at this point and then gets handed back out to each of those commanders that I showed you where all of our units are, right? So it's pretty important. You're saying, well, if it's that important, why are you just running this 240 thing? Well, that's what we were given. That's what we were told to run. So that's fine. That's what we had to run with. We've got Java applications, but the core of it, which, remember, we don't know anything about, it's all anecdotal. The core of it, we suspect, is written in Ada. Maybe C. Who knows? Lots of inter-process communication, lots of I.O. It's a pretty busy box. And it's dying. Reboot, it's fine. And it's dying. Reboot, and it's fine. We could just swap it out for something bigger, but we wanted to understand the problem before we spent the effort, which kind of goes against what I said about if we got a problem, we just swap it out, right? We didn't really have the space in the rack, in all honesty, for anything bigger, so we needed to take some time. So we're looking at load balancing. First thing we do is we take some of those data feeds, we shift them around. We spread out the thing trying to mitigate the problem, which worked a little bit, but it didn't solve the problem. Can we increase our memory? Well, I think we were maxed out on that box, but, you know, it's something we could look at. What tools do we have to work with? We've got the 0202 release of Solaris 8, and we've got nothing additional, and we don't have Solaris Management Console. So all we've got are these things like VMstat, IOstat, PRstat, these kinds of tools. So we look at what could the problems be. We started, you know, use this as a teachable moment. And in all honesty, I have, for the purposes of the presentation, put things in an order that suits the presentation rather than the way we did them. But we did all of these steps along the way. Is the problem I.O.? The database that holds the position of every cow that needs milking out in the desert is highly transactional. Every dot on the map goes into a file. So are we having problems with I.O.? We look at IOSTAT, and as I've heard in some, last year at least, I learned the term, your discs are earning their paychecks, but it doesn't mean that they're not doing their jobs. We didn't have run queues building up. We didn't have thrash, you know, the system wasn't having problems. Could it be the memory? Look at the VM stat. Is our swap being overrun? Is our system thrashing? Are we out of RAM? The historical knowledge of the system is RAM is the is always the problem. But it wasn't the problem because our virtual memory looked fine. Are the applications going crazy? We look at the PR stat, and we, you know, PS, just regular tools like this, to see what kinds of things the processes are doing. We've got some processes holding on to the CPU, but they're just doing their jobs. We use some priority control, try to knock them down. Helps a little bit, but doesn't really get the job done. The system's doing its job poorly, but it doesn't seem to be that the applications are being pathological. They're just overworked. Could it be the CPU? This is what we've always been told with this system. The CPU is never the problem because it's all single-threaded in the core of the system, because it's this 15-year-old ADA code. Chills, eh? So we use this PSR admin to knock out one of the processors, and we get this idea by bringing processors on and offline that the system is indeed very sensitive to the number of CPUs that are running. So we come to the conclusion, let's increase the number of processors. The Sunfire 240 only takes two processors, so we upgrade to a 440. All of this, by the way, gave us time to make room in the rack, which we would have done originally, but we didn't have any time. So, okay, you guys work on the debugging. The other ones of us will take a system down, pull it out, whatever. So we swap the disks, put in the 440 with the additional CPUs, and it works fine. But, okay, so you put in a bigger system. Is that such a big deal? Remember, we're trying to learn about something that is closed to us. This is a black box application. So we're using this as that teachable moment. Let's knock a processor out, knock two out, knock three out, see how that system behaves. And what we discovered is that the data channels that bring in that land picture, that sea picture, that air picture, are multi-threaded, and they're very sensitive to the number of processors. And the RAM that they're using, the amount of memory they're using, is not such a big deal. So what we ended up doing in our little niche of the world was completely turning on its side what it means to tune one of these systems. The people behind the systems, we're done with the technical part now. I kind of ran out of things that I could show you without having to ask you to leave the room while I was showing you. The people like me, the people that work on these systems, tend to be prior service people because it's a classified environment. You need a security clearance to work on the global command and control system as a system administrator. Do I know any secrets? I'll tell you later. The answer is no, I don't know any secrets, but I have access to networks that also have secret data along the way. So we have to have the security clearance, that military training to understand the context. You guys have just had an hour-long little seminar on command and control and military doctrine. So this hopefully is something interesting to you, but that kind of context is important. If you don't know anything about email, then how can you be a good sendmail administrator? If you don't know how to drive a car, how can you be a really good mechanic? Yeah? So that military background is very useful. Your average GCCS system administrator probably doesn't have a degree yet because he just came out of 4 years in the Army. So we've got a lot of people that are very motivated, people that are very very dynamic in their thinking because they're trying to do two things. They're trying to do good at a job, and they're trying to improve themselves along the way. Our leadership tend to be a retired non-commissioned officer, retired captain or something like that, or we've got some active duty people involved as well. So I sit right next to an Air Force Master Sergeant every day, and on the other side of me is an Air Force Lieutenant Colonel. So it gives a different flavor to how you do business, especially when I'm the long-haired hippie guy that gets told every day to get a haircut. To which I always have to shake it out for him just to poke it at him. So we've got the system administration side of the house for GCCS system support is these kinds of people. Developers for these applications. Now, who would want to develop a stovepipe application that written in Ada that doesn't communicate with anything else? Well, obviously Northrop Grumman would. As would Lockheed Martin, as would Raytheon, as would a lot of these other big defense contractors that you've heard of. So these are contracted out to these kinds of companies, and they're full-time professional programmers not working in classified environments. You have a software engineering degree, a computer science degree, and you say, wow, that talk I saw from Andy Seeley at CENTCOM is one of the hottest things I ever saw, and I can't wait to program on legacy operating systems. Hey, you know, everybody got a twitch, right? So maybe that's yours. And my twitch is cherry pie. But there's some pie here in Washington that I'll tell you all about later. Full-time professional programmers, not cleared environments. Northrop Grumman, which is my company, kind of sounds like a shameless plug. We're the primary developer of these core systems. But I don't deal with the development, folks. You'd think that would be easy. I still don't get the source code because it's such a big company, you just don't have those lines of communication. So these are how the systems are put together. And some resources for you to, if you're really interested and you want to know more, go to Northrop Grumman, and if you can find my picture on there, say, hey, I know that guy. My picture's not on there, so you'll never know me. You got Mission Systems is the business unit that I work for inside Northrop Grumman. The Defense Information Systems Agency, the Program Management Office for GCCS, they have a website with a lot more information. United States Central Command has their public affairs website where you can see very inspiring pictures of soldiers giving candy to children. JITC is the Joint Interoperability Test Command. It's actually very interesting despite the fact that it just puts you to sleep hearing the words. They are the ones that do the interoperability testing between these stovepiped applications to ensure that it actually works as a cohesive command and control system. So it doesn't make a lick of sense. It really doesn't. And you know, people in my family or say in the academic side of my life, they say, well, exactly that. Why doesn't it have more cohesiveness? Why doesn't it work better? And one of the lessons that I always remind my junior guys that work for me is don't be shocked when the system breaks. Be shocked that it works at all. Be happy. Be happy that it works. It's like being I'm from Tampa. It's like being a Tampa Bay Buccaneers fan, right? As opposed to who's winning the Super Bowl this year? I don't know. Who's a good team? Dallas? Okay, so let's say you got a really good team, you got a really bad team. If you're a fan of the really good team, what do you get? You get status quo and unhappiness. If you're a fan of a really bad team, you get status quo and happiness. Because if your good team loses, you're like, oh, Jesus Christ, my team lost. And if they win, you're like, yeah, that's what I expected. The opposite is true in this environment, right? If it works, you're like, hallelujah, it worked. And if it breaks, you're like, yeah, that's what I expected. So that's the answer to the question is it doesn't work. They don't work well together, but there's so many different organizations, so many different lines of funding, so many different contracts that are let out in different ways that the fact that we're able to, for better or for worse, go invade foreign countries is really pretty amazing. And the Department of Defense website is interesting reading. You know, y'all are so used to getting like links to like cool little like, you know, URL hacks or something like that. I've been doing that all week. Hey, I'm going to go look at that guy's link. Y'all are looking at this and just foreheads will slap on the table here shortly. Joint Vision 2020 is fascinating reading, but you have to take it with a pot of coffee because it's really it's terrible. But it's important. If you're interested in this kind of line of work, if you're interested in this kind of system support role, it helps to know what your mission is. If you work for a bank, you've got a mission of securing financial transactions. If you work for a university, you've got a mission of, I don't know, making the professor happy. If you work for something, you have a mission of something. The mission of the joint forces of the United States is defined in Joint Vision 2020. This is how the United States intends to fight a war 15, 20 years from now. And they talk about the technology. Here's what we, the chiefs of staff, expect our technology to do. And that's interesting reading. That's like a look into the future because for better or for worse, regardless of how your political pendulum swings, Department of Defense of the United States is really driving a lot of innovation. And if the Department of Defense says, we really want to see something, you will see it at some point. So it's good reading for that. And this is me. If you're interested and you want to know more, you say, hey, I really need to work for Northrop Grumman, and I hear that Andy gets a great recruitment bonus for everyone that gets hired, drop me a line, give me a call. I don't mind taking phone calls or anything. And a shameless plug, last year we put on a system administration and engineering conference for GCCS down in Tampa, Florida. And we're doing it again this year. We're planning to do it again this year, out in September. And so it's what we try to do is bring together not just the government, but also the pure industry. We had some pure industry folks there last year, and it was a breath of fresh air. You are a breath of fresh air to me because, like I said at the beginning, you know, you're the people that are underground keeping things running, and then I'm under another underground. So to be part of industry and to bring industry to us really, really is something. And can you believe it? Just as we come to the end, my voice completely gives out. So can I take any questions?
All right, and if you do have questions, we have microphones on both sides, so please, please come up to the microphones. Don't just shout them out. Andy, I'm going to throw one at you, though. You mentioned DISA. DISA, in April of 2006, published an open technologies roadmap. So I'm wondering if that has actually filtered down to your level, and you know, because it does talk about starting to use more of these open source, open technologies that are out there, not being stuck in proprietary land.
That's a really good question, and it brings us to what we call the many heads of DISA, because it's such a big organization that our piece doesn't talk to that piece. So DISA does have initiatives like, let's bring Linux in, let's use a lot more Linux applications. Linux in the government world, it's that those hippies. Well, it turns out it's a pretty gosh darn good operating system, right? And it is being used in government, but the pace is glacial. Will we ever see that kind of initiative in this kind of system? Probably 10 years from now we'll start to see that. But right now, it's just not happening.
Okay. Over there.
How do you quantify uptime in such a system? Or do you have any demands for a higher availability?
We always have demands. It has to be up, has to be up, has to be up. But for better or for worse, our leadership is not always savvy enough to give us a measurable metric. They say it has to be up 99% of the time. That's what I work with. But in terms of how do I prove that to them, we don't. What we do is, as soon as we think there's a problem, we shift data feeds to another system. We've got our forward headquarters, so we have full redundancy. And if I think I'm going to have a problem, if there's a hurricane coming, first sniff of wind, we shift the data feeds forward and hope the camels don't eat the cables.
So two questions. Firstly, is anyone actually working on making it so you don't have these stovepipes? And the other is, how much proxy code do you end up writing for, you know, this system needs to talk to that system, and they have no idea what each other can say?
There's always somebody that's got a great idea like that. And in terms of putting these systems together, the problem is not technical, though. And that's what really makes folks like us cry. It's not a technical problem that these systems are being built where they don't talk together. It's political. This money to build this system for, say, readiness, and this money to build this system for situational awareness, it came from two different organizations. And they don't talk to each other because they weren't told to talk to each other. So how do we glue them together? Do we build that kind of middleware? Absolutely we do. And the Bourne shell is my friend. Pearl is my friend, and that's the way we do business. And every now and then, we just completely reinvent the split command.
I know that for my job, access to the internet, both to read what other people have done and to be able to question, you know, other people who have done things much longer than I have, is a huge resource. I'm wondering if you have that same sort of access, or if your people out in the field have that, and if you don't, how do you get around it?
That's the subject of an initiative that we've put together. Everyone's got their knowledge base of where they get their information and all. And in industry, we can go out, if you need to recompile your Linux kernel, you go to a Linux how-to or something like that. We've put together what is basically a wiki on the secret network. And the intent is that I'm a system administrator, I have a problem, I fix that problem, I jam my solution in there. You're a system administrator using my notes, and you say, hey, Andy got it wrong. He doesn't need all this Perl code. He needs to, you know, read the man page on, you know, a certain command. so proud of that code, too. And and so we have a system like that in place. And I share it with the other sites, the other commands, with the hope that we're able to start bringing people together like that. Because not only are we as command and control systems administrators isolated from you, the rest of the known universe, we're isolated from one the other as well. I'm working at United States Central Command. My previous job was United States European Command in Germany. We never talked to the Central Command. I got an award for calling Central Command because they were such jerks. I'm not even making it up. Because they the different sites don't crosstalk too much. Me having come from one to the other is... I don't know, is that like going from Sun to Microsoft? I mean, it's like, it's a big deal. So I'm really the guy who's bridging two major commands right now, trying to do exactly what you're talking about. And so far we're coming along, but it's glacial pace of change is what we're all about.
So I work for Google's hardware operations, so I'm sort of intimately attuned to the potentials of old hardware and how do you deal with finding RAM and disks and various and sundry things you will inevitably need when you have aging hardware. So how do you handle the potential downfalls of that? And as an adjunct for your system administration and engineering conference, if you need a presenter for Split and CAT, give me a call.
Don't walk forward, not back, because in all honesty, to have a Google presenter would probably double my attendance. We had 120 people from 10 countries last year. I'm hoping for 200 this year. And what do we do with the old hardware? Sure. We had in our forward headquarters, we had Enterprise 4500 running an Oracle database. Thing blew up. Not literally blowing up like an explosion, it just stopped working. The skills that we had on site were, you know, we didn't have the troubleshooting skills. We send somebody forward. They go look at it and say, okay, we've got a bad main board or something like that. Well, where do you buy an Enterprise 4500 today? And that's what we did. But see, it's a problem because in order for the government to buy something from you, there has to be contracting in place. Our contract lawyers talk to your contract lawyers. We have to put it out for bid. We take three bids, and we take the best three bids, take the lowest priced one of those. It's incredibly complicated. Spin the dial, put your left leg on the yellow dot. But we have a government credit card, and it has a max limit of $2,500. So I called the guy that was selling this and said, hey, brother, what can you do for me? And we got it to where he took $2,500 for this system that was exactly what we needed. He puts it on a pallet, ships it to us. I think we build the shipping separately. And he ships it to us. We put it on a C-130 or whatever kind of aircraft it was, and it goes over there, and we plug it in, and everything was good. So eBay is not just for not just for civilians anymore.
Maybe you can't answer this. I don't know. How big is your sysadmin organization in where you work and some of the other sites?
I can't answer that, but I'll have to see you later. My office is actually one of the biggest of its kind around. We have seven contractors and seven military folks, and I'm actually hiring. We're looking to add six contractors. I need a security clearance, an IT background, the willingness to live in a tin can for 3 months at a time in the desert. So if you qualify, come on down. So we're pretty big like that. The other organizations, European Command in Germany, where I came from, they've only got six civilians, and that's it. They're also not fighting a war, so they have less work to do. The GCCS site in Atlanta, they've got two guys in a uniform, two contractors and one military guy. So it can go from being, Djibouti has one guy, and his name's also Andy. There's two Andys in GCCS, and he's the other one, and one guy. So 24 hours a day, if something blows up, they go get him out of his tent.
I really enjoyed your presentation. All the three problems that you mentioned, however, were all looked very tactical to me, in the sense that once the infrastructure has been built, you are trying to figure out how to make a certain piece of software work for which you don't have any documentation and things like that. But who does the overall planning for the infrastructure, like figuring out that it should be architected in such a way that there is no single point of failure, or if there are, then...
Well, you know, the word planning is something that I'm having trouble with there. Did you say planning?
Well, wait a minute. So obviously, somebody has to plan it, because the network didn't exist in the Middle East, right?
Before
you went to war. So how does that happen? How long does it take? How many people get involved?
One of the logistics system that I mentioned was a joint operation planning and execution system. In 1998, they planned an upgrade of it called JOPES 2000. We didn't get JOPES 2000 until 2005. So that was 7 years to upgrade from Oracle 7 to Oracle 8. So the pace of change for those kinds of for the planning is very, very slow. Now, who's doing it is happening in this Defense Information Systems Agency at higher levels. They're looking at requirements from the field commanders, from the people who make the decisions about we're going to fight a war with this person in this way, or with this country, hopefully. We're not going to fight a war against... Right, we do fight wars against individuals nowadays, right? And we still don't find them. So we're going to... The commanders who make those kinds of decisions are the people who feed the requirements back into the government, or into DISA, and then those requirements come back down into the planning for the capabilities. Then the contracts get let out for the development and such as that. So it gets done at a high level, not a lot of consultation from folks at my level, but a little bit from here to here. Once they decide what the systems are going to be, the contracts are let, the software is developed, then the configuration management, that type accredited system that I mentioned, gets handed to me, and then I decide, okay, I'm going to use that system off that shelf, put it into that rack with that power, those comms, and then it's up to me to do things like redundant comm, data paths out to the cloud, things like that.
Okay, so approximately how long does it take when the mission, when the decision is made to, you know, go to war at place X?
Oh, that's a big question about that. That's an operational question. Right. From a systems perspective, if we have an upgrade, when we upgrade from a version X to version Y, we'll get advance notice of that a year out, and they'll say a year from now we're going to do it. So then 2 years later we actually do it. So we have plenty of time to prepare for that.
Okay.
We've been planning for Solaris 10 now for 2 years. Well, we're not going to see it for another two, it turns out. We're supposed to have it last year. But we do get advanced knowledge that a new system load is coming so that we can prepare for it.
Thank you.
IPv6. The DoD has notionally a desire to get IPv6 on presumably this very network and other things related to it. If is that actually going to happen?
For the command and control system, as GCCS, probably never. When they change its name to NECC or whatever the next best thing is, maybe they're looking at it. It hasn't shown up on my radar at all, though.
Okay, we have a few minutes left, so if you are at all hesitant or been hesitant about getting up and asking a question, now is the time to do it. I also want to remind you folks that if you liked this particular session, if you have anybody that you think you would like to be an invited talk speaker at next year's LISA, it's not too early to think about it now.
And thank you all. We got another... And thank you all very much for coming and being patient with me. This is...
Well, wait, I'm going to ask you one more question.
And I got one more question. Okay. Then I'll thank you for being patient.
Something that a lot of folks out here don't encounter very much, which is the notion of foreign software. Wondered if you guys have had difficulty with that. Sometimes the answer that you need lies in something called foreign software. Works great when you have somebody like Novell by SUSE, and something that was foreign software is no longer foreign software. But wonder if you've encountered that and frustrations with that kind of problem.
Everything that is not given to us in a black box is foreign software. And so that's, I mean, like, I keep harping on the split command, but obviously we can't use that. It's made by communists. We don't, as for, as what? Yeah, foreign software, if it doesn't come in the bag that we're handed, then it's not ours to use. And that's, That's the short answer. The long answer is we have to, if the solution to a problem is to have a piece of software, I would love to have a compiler on my systems, because I'd write C code instead of Perl, and then I'd just call it split and I'd be done. And so with that, we have to go with our hat in our hand to the information assurance people. We have to say, here's what we want to do with a new piece of software, and they have to do a special security assessment on it. They look at what industry says about it. They do their own code review, I guess. And then they finally, it goes through configuration management boards, and it has to be signed off by the general. You see, it's terrible. It's like yanking your own teeth out with pliers. So we make the best, we do the best we can with what we've got is the end of the day.
It was my understanding that the National Security Administration was willing to do thorough analysis on software for government agencies to make sure that there weren't backdoors, other types of complications, you know, basically on request of, you know, any federal agency. Don't you folks engage them, and is that because there's kind of like a wall between divisions?
That's exactly the thing, is that we have, our system is accredited as a system. And that accreditation is not done by NSA. It's done by a different government agency. So we don't have that kind of flexibility. And even if we did, the initiative probably wouldn't come from our lower levels, because we're support, we're not function. Right? The purpose of this is fighting the war, so of course we listen to General so-and-so. The purpose of this is not to make it easier to maintain, you knucklehead Andy. You know, why would we listen to you? Is the atmosphere that we deal with. So it would be very nice if it was that flexible, but the reality is that we just don't have any flexibility at all. Indeed so. So we end up having to have our feet on both sides of an ever-widening gap. Sir?
I also work for a defense contractor.
Yay! Which one?
Raytheon.
All right.
And we have all kinds of security requirements that we have to report and audit machines for DSS. I was wondering if you guys have the same ones, and how do you handle it with all the old, decrepit operating systems?
When you say audit, you mean like C2 level auditing in the operating system. We have a requirement to do auditing, and for some reason, we don't have a requirement to ever do anything with the audits. So, to be perfectly candid, and candor is not a typical function of government stuff, so sorry about that, but we live with the same requirement that you do, but up until now, where we're increasing staff, we haven't had staff to do anything with the product.
So how much license do you have to create your own tools? I mean, you re-implemented Split. Now, whether or not that was in the black box that you were given is another issue, right? Maybe you didn't know about it.
Gray area. Well, in all honesty, I'd completely forgotten about it up until this moment.
So, you know, but it might have been a stripped-down system that didn't have it because it wasn't necessary for the function.
And that's the kind of problem we have. So the latitude that we have is gray. Sure. It's a gray area.
Don't ask, don't tell? Don't ask, don't tell?
Well, that's also gray, or perhaps rainbow color. But the but the issue that we have is that we're not allowed to do programming. We're not allowed to do software development. We're not allowed to go buy software and put it on the system. But, oh, by the way, they can't very well give us a Solaris machine without the Born shell. And it turns out that Perl is integral to a lot of the applications that the government gives us. So we have tools, but we don't have a toolbox. So as long as we don't make a big deal about it, as long as we don't say, hey, look, here's my glorious application that I'm selling on eBay or something, we get away with it. But it is kind of, it's open to interpretation. When my homegrown Split command, did I do software development? And the bidding starts at $10. Did I do software development? I scripted. So scripting's okay, programming is not. And I'll leave you to interpret where the line is, because I don't think there's a line. There's kind of a gap between the two, which is the challenge, by the way. And you've got your finger on the pulse of why I like my job. I like my job despite the fact that it sucks, because it forces me to be creative. It forces me to think in new ways. It forces me to say, here's a perfectly good hammer, I'm going to go get a rock. And it's good because of that. It requires mental agility, because you don't get the good stuff. You only get the bad stuff.
Is that one more question coming?
Yay, one more question.
So, how do you deal with patch management? Like, does it just get injected into your machines, or you get a new image, or it just doesn't happen at all?
A little of column A and a little of column B. If a patch is released for something, we are constrained. Such a patch gets released today because the kernel panics when you go boot. We are not supposed to go download that from Sun and install it. We're supposed to wait for the organization to give it to us in a repackaged, a repurposed patch. And that system works. It just doesn't work as fast. We should be doing it today. We do it next month. But it does get done. It just gets done in big chunks. They'll roll them up.
You end up with basically a cluster.
Just like that. We do like a jumbo patch kind of thing every few months.
Do you have some support?
Yeah, we do. But not in a direct way in terms of I went and bought this system, so I bought the maintenance. The Sun has engineers that are assigned directly to this program. So I do have guys that I can... Nope. The only guy that I have within 100 miles is a sales guy that whenever he calls me, he wants me to buy something. But I'm just a contractor with no budget, and I can't do anything. And even if I could buy stuff, I'd have to buy it through a DOD program that goes through Washington. Are we out of time? Thank you guys for coming. Thank you.
Okay, the next event after this on the calendar is the Lisa Carnival O Fun in Salon 1 and 2 at 6:30. See you.